I'm not being facetious. I've never heard that word before.
Really?
No.
Horseback scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait. Designation: Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, We All About Lost Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Tanya Gates.
Hey everybody.
And Adam Camilleri.
Yo ho ho. And a bottle of rum, I don't know.
It's the wrong season. Season of
It totally is, and I don't drink, so it's very unapt, but here we are.
I know we promised some Orktober content, and we actually have a little bit of Ork news. You know, we actually do a tournament rundown show over on the Frontline Gaming Network, Adam and I do with Dustin Henshaw, and Orks were out in force.
Yeah, SoCal Open coming up this weekend. I don't know if this will be coming in before or after, but if it's after, go check out some of
during,
the VODs. Of
hopefully.
It'd be during. So go check out some of the VODs and the live stream if you catch it. But yeah, 13 Orks in representation of 178 players, which is more than I thought they'd be.
Well, folks out there, maybe they are playing them for some little bit of Orktober, you know, love. If this is something that helps you get your figures off the shelf and onto the table, or you found an interesting thing, maybe the gamers in your area have shifted to something that where you think the Orks are going to do better, let us know, because that's something we will pass on, folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been working on an Ork list just for like pickup games at the store, and I don't know. I like, because I play Death Skulls, right? So I lean into the obsec of Death Skulls.
Yep.
So it's just like so much infantry on the board, and I've tested it out twice, and I don't know. I think if I play it a little bit more, I think it could maybe hold up. We'll have to see.
The killing ability of Orks in the competitive meta is either, it's an on switch. There are lists where it's really good, and there's lists where it does one half of nothing. To get around that, you need to be able to play the mission when your damage isn't good. But a lot of people have just been all inning on that by taking, you know, just massed goff waves, which I'm here about, because it's thematic, it's awesome on the table, it's fun, it's for both players. But if you want the backbone, I think Death Skulls is a really great way to play. Death Skulls or Blood Axes. If you want to have just a decent scoring ability all the time, like that backbone of just always having a game.
Blood Axes had that surprise stratagem too, which is pretty good.
Yeah, Blood Axes have a lot going. Well, Blood Axes just have a whole supplement on top of what everyone else gets. So, you know, there's always that little bit of extra on their name. But yeah, I'm here for it. I think there's a great ability for Orks. Orks is one of the ones where, I mean, we're going to talk about the balance slate in a little bit, but Orks is one where I really would have liked to see them get a little bit of something.
You know, rollback Admech style? That's a...
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't think people would be enamored to see the Freebooters list back again, but I'd love to see just kind of... something like what Armor of Contempt gave. I mean, I know they tried to do something with the Wah giving you the invulnerable save now, but I have a theory about what I want G-Dub to do at this point of an edition, which we can unpack in a bit, because it is a big topic in and of itself. But
there's a bunch to slide here, the levers and the buttons to push and all this kind of stuff. Is that you've got the points, you know, of course, the points per unit. You've got the points per stratagem, you know, command points and how much things cost. And what we saw, and this was alluded to in like the video they put out for the MetaWatch that they publish, is that you know, when command points were more plentiful, raising a stratagem up to 2 command points seemed appropriate. Now the command points were less plentiful, then lowering it down seemed more realistic. So that's one way of doing it. Then we got keywords, and then there's this whole new thing. And this actually came about, like the whole perception of this has come about because of Nephilim and the changes of opening up not just one faction secondary, you can take multiple faction secondaries, and then just the second, having good secondaries or not can make an army that has, let's just say, less advantageous stratagems or lower points values or whatever, still amazing because of their access to points during the game.
I mean, Necrons being the case in point there, right?
Yeah. Sisters, you know, I think it to some degree, but yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. There's some I mean, there's some pros
Orc's got none of that,
too.
By the way. So I'm just saying that that was something that could have done. It could have happened.
There are a lot of pros and cons to the way Games Workshop is going about this and why they're kind of restructuring their own mentality. There are a lot of ways to adjust this game. And I've said this at nauseam, and I'll say it again. This has got to be such a ridiculous and monumental effort to balance, because on top of there being, well, we're into the low to mid 20s of individual factions, and each faction therein having a multitude of different units with war gear options. And that's just the miniatures. That's not even talking about the constructs we build upon them, the subfactions, the stratagems, the bullet traits, the relics, the psychic powers, the secondaries, etc., etc., etc. So there's a multitude of different balancing factors. It's good for GW to share with us their philosophy, like where they're coming from, how they're trying to do it. I don't necessarily agree with the use of win percentages. Overall win percentages. I know that that's the easiest way to get the broadest impact, is to just look at the overall win percentages, but it really doesn't take into account the player base, the individual player base of said fact.
I think win rate
is a great thing to know, and it should be the starting point about informing yourself about why a faction is over or underperforming. It's like the gateway knowledge. So you look at a faction like Tyranids, which was, to all intents and purposes, the best performing faction of the last 3 to 6 months, and you see, they've got the best representation, they're the best win percentage. Why? And then you ask, then I think logically you've got to ask yourself, why is that? I should be like, well, is that because of the amount of top players that play them? Is that because of how accessible they are to new players, which is a great thing for Necrons, is extremely accessible and cheap army to Starkers in the starter box. And it's very quick to paint and model and get on the table. Is it because of they have a single subfaction that is over and abundant dominant? Do they have a single mechanic that makes them good?
It's just always taken or whatever.
Yeah. And so your starting point, you look at where the aberrations are in win percentage, and then you kind of build your knowledge base off that. And so I do love how GW's coming about it by actually using knowledge of game statistics and such, because I think it's a definitely a much better way of doing it than arbitrarily doing it off opinions and whatnot.
Yeah, the proof is in the pudding, kind of thing. And what we see, again, we look at participation at events, as an indicator of what is strong or struggling or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we see, pretty good diversity in what's out there.
I mean, right now, we undoubtedly, if anybody has any complaints about the game right now, you'll be looking back, 4 years from now, thinking about this 6 to, possibly 9 month, possibly 12 month period as being the best part of this edition. I think that hands down cannot be argued. This is the best the 9th edition has been. We saw this echoed around a similar state of 8th edition, around this kind of position in 8th edition, where just about every codex had been released. We had this piece of stability where everyone was kind of had a little bit of a fighting chance, or could play in a way that was rewarding.
I'm appreciating. I like what they're doing. I like that they are coming out and kind of letting us see a little bit behind the curtain, how, quote unquote, the sausage is made.
Yes.
As it were.
Well, in saying that, the reason there's a lot of reasons why I don't agree with the way they're doing it, mostly because I think, and this is a great point to talk about with orcs, orcs essentially are, I don't want to say being propped up by a single archetype, but they're a great example of an army that has a single competitive build that performs better than the rest. The full, orc rush, green tide, goth list performs generally better than all the others.
To get him into that 48% win rate or whatever, but
it doesn't respect the fact that a whole sub-faction can be propping up a whole multitude of people who are playing other sub-factions of that army. And so they're getting zero credit or zero thought given to
consideration
to the game.
Consideration. I don't believe that's true, but you're saying you at least believe there's a perception that could be happening.
I do believe so. I think orcs are a great example of that. I think the best example of that is Leviathan Tyranids. While this is a bit of a misnomer, because I think when we unpack what has happened with Leviathan Tyranids getting dealt with, Tyranid Warriors and Zoanthropes getting dealt with really harshly, which absolutely they needed. It is one sub-faction that is an overabundance of representation. I think it's in the high 80% of all players and all games lodged with Tyranids in the past 3 to 6 months has been solely with Leviathan Tyranids. So when you take away and nerf Leviathan specifically, fantastic. That is the right thing to do. But then you go through other places, like a great example of this would be Space Marines. When you give Armor of Contempt, yeah, sure, it's helping the Imperial Fist players, it's helping the Raven Guard players who've had very little to, you know, very little to attach themselves to or get excited about or, you know, believe in. But then you're also helping Blood Angels, which is the one
I don't like how examples going anymore.
But it's the one powerhouse out of Adeptus Astartes. It's the one powerhouse out of that codex. And so you're helping the beggars of that codex, but you're also helping the richer getting richer, if you know what I mean. When you buff a whole faction, which is why this is my talking point for us. Is there a better way to do this? And I'm saying they're already doing it in a good way, but this is Adam's hot take, which is a hundred times harder than what they're doing right now, which means they're never gonna freaking do it. But I would like to see them go through and nerf sub factions a lot more, and by nerfing the best sub-faction of each faction.
Does it have to be a nerf, or can it just be like you just want to see more focus on the sub-factions?
Well, it can be the opposite, but this is the easy way to do it. The harder way to do it is to buff up all the other sub-factions around the one that's dominant. Because in 9th edition, I would say this almost isn't a generalization. Just about every faction has a dominant sub-faction, which gets played like Leviathan Tyrannus does. Case in point, Necrons with Eternal Expansionist and Conquerors. Case in point, Sisters with Bloody Rose. Case in point, you know, Cult of Strife. Case in point, Dark Technomancers.
It seemed to be like, if you're going to play this faction, this is what you take.
This is the only one you can take, which invalidates, you know, 80% of the rest of a codex. And I feel like G-Dub's doing such phenomenal work in making codexes diverse and have different play patterns and different ways to enjoy them and play them and experience them. And then you go to play them and there's only one real style to enjoy.
What you're describing, and I think we're probably being very guilty of this right now. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, we're focusing on tournament play. And that is not the only
thing. Absolutely, we are.
And tournament players, you know, what, you know, a trait that is very common amongst them, not again, certainly not against everybody, is that they kind of, you know, crave that efficiency and look for to trim as much fat off list as possible. And so that does lead them to one or two faction choices.
Exactly right. And stuff, I mean, as much as this is a meme in the trickle-down economics or of top meta play, but that knowledge trickles down to other players, and then it influences, it does have an influence over the entire scheme of the game. I mean, even if you are a casual or casual competitive player, everyone likes to know what the best way to play their army is. Whether when you eschew that, you know, as Tanya does and Red does a lot of the time, even yourself, Paul, at times, to play the thing you enjoy, the thing you love, the thing that gets you passionate and gets you excited about your faction, all the power to you. You should be able to do that. But just about everybody I know likes to know what the best part of their book is.
Yeah.
I feel like, at least in terms of the orcs, I feel like there was a sub-faction that was a problem, right? But they didn't address that. They addressed more the units that sub-faction was using to, like, be more efficient. That trickled down to more, like, collectors and narrative players, because now they couldn't use their collection the way that they had built their armies and whatnot. And I do think that in that case, in that specific case, I think addressing free Buddhas probably would have been better.
Then what you're referring to them is they nerfed all the buggies, right? They made all the buggies more expensive. They made them, you know, nerf their weapons, nerfed indirect fire, etc.
And you couldn't take as many of them.
Yeah, exactly right. You can only take, what, one squadron of each, if I remember right?
You can take one unit,
three max buggies or whatever. But with focusing on the sub-factions, and you see this with Tyranids, because Tyranids have swayed, like you've seen, sometimes you see Leviathan, sometimes you see, not Jormungandr, although I think we have seen that recently, but the Kraken.
Jormungandr, yeah. Kraken, that's right.
So having the depth there is a point that, you know, lets players shift and meander through that efficiency and evolve and adapt within the course of their book without maybe updates.
What I was trying to get at is that I feel like this is a good thing for G-Dub as well, because, you know, when it comes to the end of 9th edition, we look back at the Sisters Codex, we're not going to remember Argent Shroud. We're not going to remember Martyred Lady or whatever. We're just going to remember the Bloody Rose build. There are so many more units in that book than just what gets taken in Bloody Rose, which is, you know, spammed Repentia, spammed Zephyrum, et cetera, et cetera. You know, where's the army that makes the pennant engines and the mortifiers feel good? Where's the army? You know, this is what I mean. Like, G-Dub gets to activate so much more of their rules writing, so much more of the joy they build into books by just letting us take more sub-factions of it. And so I feel like that could be a great way of doing it. And like to Tanya's point, it puts the focus away from having to balance points as much and having to have the points perfect and having the units too good or too bad. There will always be units that are best in slot. I'm using, you know, quotation marks right now.
Yeah, great for
yep. Absolutely. That's why I had to say it. There will always be a best in slot for what you want a thing, what you want a unit to be. Like Sanguinary Guard, best in slot, elite's choice with a jump pack, etc. You know? But the fact that, you know, we might go through a whole editions of the game where there's only been one subfaction of relevance which only rewards certain units, I feel like it's a big shame. I feel like that could be a thing that G-Dub could do better in the future. But like I said, this is all Adam wishlisting, and it's a phenomenal amount of work. Like what they're doing right now, just kind of nerfing the top, bringing up the bottom, it's far more reasonable.
It's just opinions, you know? So
yeah, in saying that, I'm not sure that's what they did with this one, nerfing the top, bringing up the bottom. I'm calling this Data Slate swing and a miss. That's a strike one from Adam.
Well, I mean, I think that the meta, it's more of an indication that what the problems or the issues that are needing to be fixed are kind of mostly fixed. You just give little nudges along the way. We shouldn't actually expect these to be upheavals every single time this released. It should just be. I would hope that there is not a ripple, you know, with each one of these.
Well, that's a fair perspective to have, I guess. I guess that's pretty fair. And to us somewhat greedy, possibly entitled gamers out here who want to...
I love how fundamental some of that is. Like, yeah, maybe.
Sometimes, possibly. Who want a shake-up, who want to see top armies come down, bottom armies, you know, skyrocket into the stratosphere. It's very clear that the rules balancing team have kind of stepped away from that, doing exactly what you said, Paul. They're looking at incremental changes because that means it's because they're quite happy with the way the game's being played. And I think they're right to be. It is in a good place. It's in the best place it's been in this edition.
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, maybe that's why the perception is some there. I mean, of course, if you're, you know, getting your teeth kicked in by a particular faction, you kind of want to see them get taken down a peg or whatever, or yourself brought up. Maybe that's not even the right way to say it. You just want to see, you want to feel like you've got an opportunity to kind of swing in there at equal weight, and you're playing one of those like Space Marine factions. You know, you didn't get that out of this.
Yeah, this didn't. I don't believe this really shook anything up at all. I don't think their changes to Space Marines and Admech are enough to significantly change their position in the game. And I don't believe they've done enough to curtail, especially Tyranids. I think Tyranids are just fine. A little bit harder to play, but just as powerful. And Harlequins are just gonna. The goalposts have just been shifted for Harlequins, and they'll adapt and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, this
episode's done. Easy. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Welcome. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess I want to highlight the fact that I do want us to get closer and closer to not needing, you know, big old updates or whatever. You know, then I think it's probably more of a product of a staggered release cycle, maybe. Who knows? I mean, again, don't have answers here. Just full on speculating the whole way. But you know that we got an update. Some stuff is a little bit different. It's not crazy different, and I don't think that's bad. I do wish that we'd leaned into the Astra Militarum. Like, yo, every gun, las guns, AP2. Frag grenades, AP2.
Yeah, boy.
Just go nuts.
Hear no arguments here. I mean, they're about to get a codex, so we're totally, totally fine to go ham right now, yeah?
That's would have been amazing, but yeah, not responsible. Would have been fun, but but not responsible.
Who cares about responsible? It's overrated.
Let's talk about also, we had a little blurb on Warhammer Fest.
Yeah, I don't quite know. I mean, what is Warhammer Fest? Somebody tell me. I know what it is, but I think we have to explain it if possible for people. Like, what does this represent?
Well, I don't think we know yet. So all that we know is you can register your interest and check out the venue for Warhammer Fest coming up next year. Let's see if I can get the date. I'll post the dates in the show notes. And it's going to be basically a giant Warhammer spectacle. Probably close.
It's in merry old England.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a full convention. Yeah, exactly. somebody told me one of the organizers is one of the big organizers for, I think it's a bunch of cosplay conventions. So they're really pulling in some big guns. They're pulling in some, like, you know, big convention making people in order to get this off the ground. So, man, go ham. I believe it's in Manchester.
Yeah, Manchester. Right? Yep.
Which is somewhere near London.
April 29th through May 1st. Has to be, right?
Has to be somewhere near London. That's a callback.
I mean, in Australian and like Canadian distances, it's pretty clear. It's like next door. Right next door. Yeah.
And some crazy stuff right now. I hear some good mates over at stateside, your side, Tanya, talking about the prices for a flight to the UK and for like a domestic flight are almost identical. So,
yeah,
I mean, go for it if you want. If you were planning a trip next year around that time to somewhere over the holiday, and you'd be like, well, I guess I could just go to the UK for the same price, and Warhammer Fest is on. Do it.
Yeah, get those tickets now. That actually didn't sound like a bad idea. I think it's going to be great. I don't know if you check out the venue itself, but the venue looks pretty awesome with the style inside of it. They're in Manchester Central.
It's huge. It's open and gorgeous.
Yeah. I understand this to be cool, immersive, you know, a destination. And we don't say that often. We reserve that word for very few events, and I believe this is going to be one of them.
The D word.
And we, of course, as we get more details or can share more details, we definitely will, because I think this is going to be awesome.
The other D word. Yeah, sorry. Anyway, I'll stop now. Where's Red? He needs to stop me. He's not here.
Got to put the brakes on. Yeah, anyway.
Who let me have a show? Who let me have multiple shows?
Oh, yeah. All right. So here we go. I am, again, interested in knowing more. Hopefully we will, because tickets are going to go up on sale November 11th. So I'm sure we'll get more details in between now and then, and we will bring them to you. Next weekend, I will be in Kansas City, Missouri. I know it's confusing if you're looking from outside the country, but Kansas City. I think there's a Kansas City in Kansas. Nobody talks about it. It's Kansas City in Missouri.
I have no idea what is going on right now.
And then you come to Canada or you go to Australia and there's like, you can't pronounce any of the places. So.
Kansas City, Missouri for the U.S. Open Series event, where there'll be Warhammer 40,000, Age of Sigmar, Hobby Challenge stuff, you know, all the things that we've talked about, and, you know, us doing some, or myself and Ignite Amati doing some live streaming with the production there, bringing you, you know, some pretty cool Warhammer 40,000 action. And we've seen some great stuff.
And this is the penultimate one to the finals, right? The second last.
So the finals, the grand narrative finale and other things. Basically what the finale is. which is going to be in Nevada at a deluxe resort, as much as I'm told. And the difference in between the finale from the previous year and this year is that this one is open to basically everybody that can come participate in these other events that are not the finales of Sigmar or Warhammer 40K.
That's cool. That's great. And only right, yeah? We don't try and... It's good they're not gatekeeping any of these things. They're not trying to make them exclusive. Like, everyone's here. We've got a few specific things for people who've, you know, put in the time and effort to get this deep into the season. Everybody else, come along, join in, enjoy it, be part of the spectacle. I love it.
Yeah, and it's really going to get done up this time, especially if you're playing in the narrative. Like, you have an opportunity to get written into the lore.
Yes, that is cool. It's been a hot minute, hasn't it, since GW did something like this.
Yeah. When's the last time something like this happened? I don't know, 5-6 years ago or something like that? I mean, it's...
Yeah. The GW used to do a bunch of these worldwide campaigns.
Maybe more than that. Maybe, and maybe because the years blend. 10-15 years ago.
They just keep on coming and they don't stop coming. And I don't know, there was a song about it or... I don't...
Stop, please.
We need Red.
Check it out. I will post some links to that because I'd love to have folks come. And if you can travel, I know traveling is not not something that everybody can do or wants to do right now. But if it is something that you can do, I highly encourage you to make, you know, one of these a trip for you, especially if you're in the area.
Because you deserve nice things.
That's right. No arguments there. And of course, you know, get to bring some, what we've seen competitors, like some of the top competitors in the country and even abroad outside the country mm-hmm. have come to participate at these things. And we've seen some pretty interesting games. Even archetypes develop over the course of the streams.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It will be no joke. The competitive level, narrative, whatever, the competitive level of this event is going to be a sight to behold.
Talking about Kansas City, as I'm talking about on the narrative side in the grand finale, which comes up in November. You know, I don't know what's going on with that.
What, don't you?
I thought you knew everything, Paul.
Well, so the narrative stuff, what I do know about it is some of the cool parts of what your experience is going to be when you get there. And as I understand it, you are going to be picked up at the airport, referred to by your warlord's name.
Oh, holy crap. That's amazing.
Be guided to your room, as your warlord or whatever. Basically going to be an immersive experience the entire way for folks that come and participate on that side of things.
God, that's... I would feel unworthy.
You are going to get... I don't know everything that's there other than that it just sounds really cool, and I'm kind of bummed that I don't get to do it.
This begs the question, what would you want to be referred to as?
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I don't know if there's any standard that you have to pick to.
Are you picking Sanguinius?
That's a good question. I couldn't disrespect Papa Sang.
Yeah, you couldn't put yourself where he is.
But Dante could be Dante. Could be Lord Commander Dante.
What's Asteras title?
Isn't it Grand something or whatever?
Something of the Lost. You could just be referred to as that.
Guardian of the Lost. Is that right?
You could just be referred to as that. No name or, other thing. Just the title.
Yeah.
Tanya?
Yes?
Do you have a suitable orc? Or would just be War Mistress?
When I'm playing orcs, I'm the Wa Mistress.
Nice.
That's pretty legit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a war boss name though? There's the Grand Arsonist and the Overfiend and
If I'm going to be perfectly honest, I haven't actually played a lot with my orcs before. It's sort of something I'm just coming back around to now because I was trying so hard to make guard work for so long. So I'm really just sort of starting to explore my collection now. So I don't think that I've really earned my war boss name yet. The day will come.
Castellan Gates. That's actually pretty good. That actually is pretty good.
You like that one?
I do. Lord Castellan Gates.
I like it. It's got a nice ring to it.
It does sound fun. Anyway, pick it up. You will not regret it, especially if you're hanging out on the weekend and want some Warhammer content. Next weekend, tune in for some live streaming and stuff like that on Twitch, Warhammer TV. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and jam some Warhammers.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Got some news to report. Adam Camilleri has actually finally started painting his knights he'd been talking about on the show. And that's not a slight. This kind of stuff takes time. I mean, you got projects, you got tournaments, you got the life, the models. You also have the models, and they're waiting on you. They're waiting for you to come give them some attention.
Well, this is kind of different. This is kind of special to me because I've been painting armies for play the express purpose of playing with them since I started back in 40K. The last time I did an army purely because I wanted to paint it, don't care that much about playing it, was in Warhammer Fantasy. It was the last time I painted an army for the sheer joy of painting an army.
That was your ogres or whatever?
Yeah, that was my ogres. Yeah. And because I painted that over years because I was a poor student at the time buying, one box of Fortnite or whatever. So, playing, it wasn't the scope. I was doing it because I was enjoying it, the journey. And so I was trying to get that back. That's what I'm trying to regain with this army. And so I wanted to plan it out from scratch. I wanted to buy everything that I needed. I wanted to test the scheme, test the effects that I wanted, test some new techniques, get a bunch of new products and ask a bunch of questions. And it took me literally a year to get to the point where I was like, okay, it's go time. It's time to do this. And so I finally finished, I finished 9 attack bikes as my last Dark Angels thing. And they're like, all right, it's go, let's do it. And so I did a couple of, got a couple of shoulder pads together, started testing schemes. I just sent a picture through to the FTN group chat of the two kind of shoulder pads that I did up. And those are the third version of each of those shoulder pads. I stripped those thrice.
Now, let me describe what you got here is that you've got the shoulder pads, you know, like of a knight. On one side, you've got a solid color. On the other side, you've got some pretty good realistic looking marble happening.
Yeah, so that was one of the things I practiced a lot and stripped, because I'm trying to do a black marble on half the shoulder pads, or half all the armor panels. I want to be half marbled, half.
Well, you've done purple. It. There's no, I mean, I know you mentioned some attempts here, but it looks like you stuck it.
Yeah, also, so I tried the last time I'd had experience doing marble, I'd used the steel wool job, where you get some steel wool, you kind of tape it down over the panel and you spray over.
I've never heard of that technique.
Fair enough. It was the first one I came across for painting marble, and I wanted to give it a go. I actually tried it on the wings of my Dark Talons, so my Dark Angels, if anybody's seen those. But I found it didn't give defined line seams. It gave more of a mottled kind of effect. And so I wanted something more defined. And someone told me about the baby wipe technique, which is essentially the same thing, but you use baby wipes. And so I put a bunch of baby wipes in the sun, right? You know, grown man on the, you know, Wednesday morning, just sunning his baby wipes. And what happens is when you pull them apart really, like, kind of delicately at the start, it pulls all the fibers out, and you actually get some really cool random effects. And then I kind of sticky taped that over, or blue tacked that over the paddle, and kind of sprayed it. But and then I had to figure out.
So you've spread the actual, you've taken the wipe, had it dry out, like a dryer sheet also, like I think for, you know, like you put in the laundry or whatever, it's very fibrous and you pull it apart and it creates all these striations. And then you use that as your, like what, your stencil over the.
Yeah. Essentially, okay. What it is. So I did that just over like flat white, and it gave me the effect, but didn't give me any differentiation. So I went back in and started trying to put spot colors under it, a little bit of blue, a little bit of off yellows and off blues, to try and make the runs look like they had more interest to them. And that took like 3 or 4 attempts, and then that was on the same shoulders, and all of a sudden it was really thick. And so I stripped it, did it again, didn't like it, stripped it, did it again. And that what you saw there is, yeah, pretty happy with that. And then it's just a gloss varnish over the top of that, and there you go. There's your, like, your marbled obsidian effect, and it comes out a treat. Like, it looks really quite spectacular, and very happy with it. So please give it a try at home. It's a lot. Once you get it down pat, you feel really confident. It feels really easy, but you feel like you're just making a big mess at the start.
What do you consider getting it down pat? Like, when is it the getting the wipe or whatever in the right spot and holding it there? Like, what's the trick?
It's pulling apart the wipe enough that you have runs without holes. And then also you have runs that are connected from the length of the panel. Because what you don't want is to have, if you look at marble, it's usually like one seam. The seams don't tend to disappear and reappear that much. You want them to start at one point and end at a point. Or if they stop, they don't restart anywhere. So, you know, having runs that, you know, go off on right angles and stuff, that doesn't work. So you want clean kind of runs. And like you said, perfect. You want it to sit as flat as possible to the thing you're painting. And then when you airbrush over it, or, you know, it's rattle can over it, you don't want to firstly, you can't have the rattle can too close, otherwise you'll get paint under the seams, especially if you're using a rattle can, because it's too pressurized. You've got to get the PSI just right on your airbrush, is something I found as well. My PSI was too, I turned it up because I was painting a bunch of metallics that I found clogged my airbrush up if it's too low PSI. So I turned it up all the way to 40 to do that. And then I found that was too hard and kind of ruined the seams because it shot underneath the fabrics. So yeah, it's a lot of little moving bits to get it right, but the most important one is making sure it sits flat and it sits flat and you got the right texture, like you pulled it apart the perfect amount, like you've deconstructed it appropriately. It's weird,
that is subjective. You'll know, I mean I know you're going for a specific effect, but you could pull it less or more to get variation over the course. I'm making some assumptions here. I'm just trying to help folks visualize.
Yeah, I 100% agree, dude. And as you can see, like, the two that I did are very different. Like, the two that I was happy with are very different, which excites me because I know I'm going to get a bunch of different effects and no two panels are going to look the same. I'm never going to use the same stretched piece of baby wipe for the same two panels, you know? So you're never going to get two that look exactly the same. in addition to that, it the undercolor I found was impactful, but not that impactful. I fully realized, and this is a thing that painters do, hobbyists do, I'm the person who's going to appreciate those undercolors the most, the little blues and yellows in the seams. I'm going to notice those. 99% of people out there are going to have no idea. But when I look at that, I'm like, ah, I put some undercolors there and I can see them because I'm looking for it. But 100%. If you don't want to do that, don't have to. Like, I mean, on my like my high monarch model, which I'm going to be doing for my house, which will be a knight castigator, which I'm going to do a sword and board castigator, by the way, like a knightly one with a shoulder. I'm going to try and do a shoulder mounted castigator bolt cannon, whatever it is, chain cannon. And that one, I'm going to put gold in the seams. I'm going to have gold running through the seams.
Nice.
Which I'm really excited to do that one, so to get even fancy. Better at it. Super fancy, so fancy. But yeah, there's a bunch of other effects I'm starting to experiment with. I'm trying to make I don't know if you guys got any tips on making an old antique-y gold. Because like the knights from my house, they're from the age of before the age of darkness, before old night. So I want the gold to look clean, not like rusty dirty, but I want it to look old as
Like a real burnished or like ancient gold.
In the past, I've done that by glazing with greens, but I did that on my Dark Angel. So I'm looking for something that's the same, but that gives me a better or deeper effect, but is just a different technique. So it feels more interesting. I'm more excited about doing it.
I mean, you know, my go-to gold is Retributor Armor. And, if you use not all on it, it will get pretty dark.
Mm.
And the reason I'm more attracted and to go in with Retributor Armor is because it spreads really well. You know, it goes on. It applies really well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful base coat, 100%.
But I think you're on the right track. Certainly.
I honestly don't know. What does antique gold look like?
It's just darker. It usually has a tint to it, depending on, you know, if it's weathered or if it's been burnished or brushed or whatnot. Or whether it's a... So I'm going for a very yellow gold. I'm not going for a white gold or a yellow gold or a red gold. So mine's going to be, you know, highlighted with mostly upgrading a silver added to the black gold that I'm using. So something that plays off that, I guess. But yeah, I'm still kind of coming to a.
I know that there's probably some people at home that are screaming like oil washes, but I don't know how to do that, so I can't really recommend it. But I wonder if you could get a similar effect by using like a dark brown contrast paint, and then maybe like carefully making sure to like soak up a little bit more of it so it doesn't pool as heavily, but it kind of leaves a tint.
Yeah. Maybe? Well, contrast paint is ridiculously new to me still. Like I've barely used them. So I'm really excited to try them out more. So yeah, if that's something that they can do, I'm 100% here for it.
I wouldn't put really it on exciting. At full strength. I'd thin it with some water first and until you build it up over time to get exactly what you want.
And yeah, like I said, this is like I spent well over a week just doing these two shoulder pads, stripping them like most of my, like a couple of hours a day getting this right. So this takes as long as it takes, and I do not care.
Well, just teach yourself a new non-metal metallics, you know?
Just do it. Just do it, Adam. Don't be weak. Go for it.
Sorry, I jumped in, Tanya, with a dumb comment.
Love it.
I personally think with a new project like this, I think taking your time in the planning stages, I think that's fine because you're actually going to end up saving time down the road, right? Yeah. Like once you know all this, like the steps that you want and all of that, I just think, I don't know. I spend a lot of time in like the sort of pre-painting planning stage on a new product or a new project. And I don't feel bad about it.
Yeah, I don't feel bad about it at all. I've got two massive armies that I can play. I mean, Guard's about to get a book, so it's like I'm going to... Yeah, and I've got enough Space Marines to play just about every Space Marine faction, sub-faction, Dark Angels style, whatever I want. So I'm not missing out on gameplay. This is just purely all about the journey, not the destination. One fun thing that that somebody sent in. You guys sent me Paul, you put the comment up last week because I want to do tree roots. I want to do branches I want to do. So the world that my night house is from, it's House Orlac, if you want to look it up. It's from a place called Darkhaven, which is very similar to Caliban, hence they're allied with the Dark Angels. They've got like a really overgrown, like Brothers Grimm, fungusy, you know, foresty vibe to their home world. So I want to do that as the scheme. Like I want pine needles and like, you know, foresty bits and pieces. And someone suggested getting tree roots and putting them in the oven. Is that something either of you have any experience with?
Well, that was to dry them out. So you basically could get them to something that could either take paint or look a little bit more natural and not be actually rotting on your base.
On my base. Yeah. I mean, God, let's do it.
I haven't tried it, but I do know that there's a lot of people who do that, not just with tree roots, but with just ground litter and dirt as well for basing materials. So,
well, you're essentially curing it, right? Yeah. I mean, so
you're just removing the moisture, and then you will, when you make basing material, you'll add moisture in the form of like watered down white glue, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Like, it's a really interesting thought. I haven't scratched the surface on that kind of stuff as a hobbyist. So, I'm really excited to give it a go. My parents run a little 10-acre farm, and I'm going to just go there like this week or next weekend and just dig up some stuff and see what I get.
I mean, look at the historical miniature makers, the painters and hobbyists and stuff like that. They are, we think we're really advanced on our, and look, some painters are out there, you know, but some things that seem like rocket science or space age technology to us is stuff that some scale modelers, you know, historical modelers have been doing for decades, millennia, mm-hmm. and have it figured out. You can go look at some of their magazines and you could just see just how you need to get far. They've already figured out some of these things that we're just discovering on our side. It's like cosplaying in engineering. You know, it's like a lot of this stuff has been possible for engineers, you know, making rockets or whatever, you know, and now cosplayers are figuring out like, oh, you could do that? That's possible? It's kind of how I feel sometimes with some of these paint techniques.
Exactly how it feels.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got, I think with that gold, you know, when you talk about using the greens, you use purples for gold too. That's another thing to give certain looks, you know, it kind of depends on, I don't think purple's right for what you're describing. Heck, it might be. Who knows? But the contrast paints for that purpose sound pretty, like a really good idea.
Yeah, the more I'm thinking about it, the contrast is it's another technique. It's another product I have no experience with. So what a better excuse to have a go.
And you can thin them down with water, although depending on what you're going for, you might want to use the contrast medium. But I found sometimes water is good enough.
Awesome.
But until you experiment, you do get a different finish, a different look. So, I mean.
Yeah. I'm also, you know, you mentioned oil washing, so pin washing. I'm going to give that a go as well. I'm going to see if that's – I'm going to try that on the skeleton first. I'm going to try the spray the whole thing, wipe it off kind of technique and give that a crack. I've got a couple – I went and bought a bunch of sponges and some mineral spirits. If people don't know what that is, so mineral – so when you have a – what is it? A flat surface or a non-gripping surface, say like a glaze varnish. When you use oil paints, they won't grip to anything. They'll just go straight into the recesses. And so people call that pin washing because you'll varnish
if you've got a glossy or satin surface.
Yeah. Yeah, you get an oil paint and it run directly into the recesses and you can shade it real quickly. And then if you get some white spirits, you can wipe it off really quickly. And so you dilute your oil paint with white spirits and then it'll run for you. It's almost like creating a shade. And then you get some white spirits and you just wipe it off the panels. I'm going to try doing that. Someone's also told me I can put that through my airbrush and I'm really scared about that because my airbrush, one of those days of painting, airbrush just I'm going to swear, bet. It's bet the whole all day. 4 hours I had set aside to paint that day, super excited, and of course that day nothing worked. Couldn't get the thing.
I wouldn't do that. People also say, you know, just run those washes through your airbrush, man. It's like, come on. I don't you know if you're
that stuff doesn't even come off your hands, okay? Washes, like, have you ever had a wash just like dry underneath your fingernails? You're not getting that out.
Yeah, we don't trust like that.
No, we're not there in our hobby journey. Some people are. Not yet. Some people are past that. Look, I don't think. I'm not. I won't speak for you.
I'm not. part of me thinks my airbrush clogs that much as it is anyway. I'm probably going to give it a go. But the first time it doesn't work for me, that's it. It's probably never again. Or maybe on this project, never again. But yeah, I'm here for it. I'm here to try everything, to be honest.
So back to the oil washing. I think that you can actually let the oil paints dry and then go back with the mineral spirits and clean it off.
I've heard that as well.
It leaves the recesses.
Yeah, and you just like do an over wipe.
You don't want it fully dry. You want it to be, well, okay, I'm sure you can get different effects because if it is dry, you can certainly get some of the product off, but not as much as you might want. So you got to, that's the deciding factor, I think.
Yeah, but if you wanted like a patinaed kind of gold, maybe you don't want to take all of it off.
Sounds good.
What was that word?
Patina.
I'm not being facetious. I've never heard that word before.
Really?
No.
It's like the aging kind of film that you get on metals and other surfaces. So like technically a verdigris would be like a patina.
Yeah, I'm like, is this a bit? Are we doing a bit now? I know.
No, I'm a humble Australian who didn't do much formal education. It's amazing I've made it this far in life. So yeah, 100% never heard that word before.
Well, the more you know.
Yeah, that's what you're going for. Look up gold patina.
I will, actually. 100%.
But yeah, mess with it. So let us know what you... I mean, you've figured it out. I mean, I'm not even kidding. That marble looks amazing.
It's awesome.
Thanks, guys. Love to hear it. Yeah. I'm very lucky as well. I've got I'm in a WhatsApp group with... Oh, some phenomenal 30K painters, you know, guys who've won Golden Demons in the past. So I have like a brain's trust of like, is this a bad idea? And they're like, yes, Adam, it's a bad idea. Is this a good idea? No, Adam, it's a bad idea. That's usually how it goes.
There's no shame in that. Running past. Before I got a little bit better at colors, I would always hit up a really good buddy of mine. Like, yo, what color should I choose as my whatever? You know, either my primary or my contrast. Based on what I've accomplished so far, what would you do as your second color? You know, and then he'd tell me, and then, you know, sometimes I'd take the advice, sometimes I wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know?
And I mean, I would be stupid not to use that resource, right? That's how I feel about it. I mean, even if they like shake their heads and be like, why is this guy still asking these dumb, like basic color wheel questions? I feel like I'd be stupid not to ask when you've got such a resource.
Well, Tanya brought this up when we're kind of talking about the pre-show in this topic is, you had a great topic, which was, I mean, if you don't mind me saying it.
Yeah, that's fine.
Is, you know, how do you choose or how do you decide to go with a custom color scheme? And then what would you choose? How would you go about the process of choosing?
Right. And I like this topic because I never paint anything like the box art. Like I'm trying to think, that's not true. My very limited amount of painted Space Wolves are painted like the box art, but that is just because they're my first army. They do. But however, now that I'm adding to them a little bit, I'm not doing box art anymore, of course. But so I like to paint off, like I like to paint my own schemes because sometimes I want to play around with the rules. I don't want to be sort of like stuck with, well, they're painted blue, so they're going to be ultramarines or whatever it is, right? Like my custodes are red and teal or turquoise, depending on how you want to see it. But and that's because I wasn't really sure which shield host I wanted to play. So I was like, I'll just do this and then I can sort of bounce around a bit. There's a few different ways that I choose. So for those custodes in particular, I picked those colors because, so I go out and I walk in nature quite a bit. And in the fall where I live, there's a lot of lichen on rocks and things. And there's this burnt red colored lichen. And then there's this like really bright, like light teal kind of lichen right next to each other on the rock. And I was like, man, that just looks so cool. Like that's such a cool color scheme. And I just sort of like loaded it into the back of my head and it just sort of sat there and waited for the perfect project to paint it. Have you guys ever been inspired by things in nature?
Yeah, not with armies yet, except, and this is going to sound like almost like trite, is the Sylvaneth.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have looks like very or like actual like natural tree type stuff, but then I wanted the weapons and stuff to look super fantastic.
I like that. I like that because like they're super magical. I mean, they're tree elves, so they should have something fancy about them, right?
That's what that was. So it was one of the wood to look realistic. Be like, oh, that is, that could be wood, you know?
Yeah. But then the other way that I pick color schemes is I'll just get like a cool paint color. Like sometimes I just go into the paint store and, oh, that looks like a cool paint color. And then I will pick it. And then I have a little app on my phone. It's like a little color wheel app. And then it allows me to take pictures and then find the actual color in the app. So I take a picture of the paint and then I can see what other colors harmonize with it. And then I pick something based off that. And that's pretty much what I've done for my orcs. It's what I've done for my night haunt.
I'm so much more basic than you two. Like, wow, I am so basic, Sir Basington on this show right now. I pick a color that I haven't painted before. Like just a base color that I haven't painted before. My knights are purple because I've never painted a purple army.
yeah. But I like that.
That is very, very basic. It's just like a color I've never tried to execute. And yeah. It was good enough.
See, I'm kind of... I have a lot of projects on the go right now because I'm also painting. I gave my Slaanesh demons to my husband because I was like, I'm never going to play these. He's playing demons. But now he's like, can you paint the rest of the Slaanesh in the same? So I'm still essentially painting another army, but I want to also start a Stormcast Eternals army at some point. And I've never painted white. And I feel like it's the time.
Yeah, it's
the time to try it and to like test myself. So a friend sent me a couple models, so I'm gonna build them and I'm gonna paint those and I'm gonna see how I feel about doing a white army. But I just think white armies look so awesome on the board.
Well executed white is one of the most striking schemes you could ever have.
What would you do as the basing or like a offset color?
I haven't quite decided, but Stormcasts are usually painted gold, so I thought maybe I would do white with like a rose gold kind of trim. But as for an accent color, I'm not entirely sure. Maybe like a green, like an emerald green. I'd have to play around with it.
I did the same thing that you did, Adam, with the yellow, like for these Leagues of Votann. I painted yellow helmets before, and yep. I'd always kind of struggle with it. And then, you know, the new techniques have come about, and I wanted to try to see if I could paint a yellow army.
Yeah, good enough. Yeah,
I love that.
I don't think there's any right or wrong. I love the idea of the color wheel, like just thinking about a thing in nature and then that level of inspiration. Yeah, I aspire to that. That's freaking awesome. Yes.
I don't know. Like, I'm always taking pictures of stuff, too, out in nature. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like Mother Nature is like figured out what colors look good together. So we can just trust her. Right?
Should back it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're looking for it. If you're making choices, you know, like, and you don't know where to start, it's a good place.
Yeah.
Well, your stuff looks amazing, like, you know, we always say, which is very true if people have not made themselves familiar with it yet.
Well, you're very kind. I am painting a giant war boss for Orktober, and he's going to be bright and gaudy. I'm at the ugly stage, so I'm looking at it going like,
That is the worst, when you are painting a model but thankfully, you have clear vision of where you want it to go. And this is probably important to talk about even when we're talking about experimenting with color schemes and, you know, people maybe starting new projects or whatever, is that almost all of these will have that awkward, ugly stage that you have to battle through.
You do. You just got to keep putting paint on it until you figure it out, pretty much.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. I'm just kidding.
Dude's got a mustache.
I missed it the first time. I got to go back in and paint the mustache.
So right now I'm painting this war boss and my orc army is mostly this really bright kind of sky blue, but I've started incorporating more of these really bright, almost fluorescent orange details into it just to like create some interest for me. And so I'm painting this war boss with the blue and the orange and on his armor, and I originally was like, I want it to be equal parts blue and orange, and I was like, no, these are like too clashing. Like, I painted the whole front of the armor and I was like, this is way too clashing. Like, one of these colors has to take center stage and the other one has to be like an accent, because this is just too crazy. So now I'm going through and like I'll paint another part that I originally painted orange. I'll paint it blue and be like, okay, is this enough? No, I got to paint something else. Paint another little part until I just get just the right amount. Just because this guy's super bold, so it's a bit of a process.
Can't wait to see how it turns out.
What's
next for your knights, Adam?
So I'm working on the skeleton right now. I'm just blocking out the black details after doing the two coats of metallic I was after. Then once I got that blacked out, I will do the panel to the actual purple panels, like, you know, the front of the front guards and the shield plates and the head casing and stuff. And then, yeah, going to try the pin wash after that. So really excited. And then when that pin wash is down, and I've got the satin layer of, sorry, the second layer of varnish on it, I'm going to switch over to the armor panels and get those up to the same point. And then it's putting it all together, doing the finishing details, a bit of weathering. Can't wait, dude.
When you are doing the working with the oils, you got to use a different brush.
Yeah, one you don't care about, right?
Well, I mean, it should still be a good brush because you still want it to be able to come to a tip, but have that be your dedicated oil brush, and it will wear out faster simply for the cleaning process of the white spirits and stuff.
Yep.
To where you should not become emotionally attached to that brush, but it still should be a good one.
Yeah. Not good tips.
And, you know, clean it separately. Remember, I don't know if you lick your brush, but don't lick that one.
I am a certified brush licker.
Ditto.
You got to break the habit on that one, my friend.
That's going to be rough. I'll send you a picture of my face. Yeah.
You may want to put a brightly colored piece of hazard tape on that or whatever. Do not do that. But clean it. That's something that I don't know. It always gets talked about in the tutorials, is that you really can't clean it in water. You can get a lot off in water and a towel and stuff, but to really clean the brush, you got to use the same thing that you're thinning the paint with, which is the spirits.
Yeah.
And that will cause the brushes to break down. When I say a good brush, I'm not saying it's got to be like a $20 brush or whatever. You can have a cheap brush, but that can get to a good point.
Ah, great tip, man. Thank you.
There we go. Well, that is our show this week. Got all this kind of stuff coming up.
It's a good time.
Yeah, it is. Going to close out this year very strong.
It's gonna be a bumper year for the community and all the games.
Looking forward to seeing how these tournaments play out over the course of the next couple of weeks. I hope folks tune in next weekend to see us on the live stream. I hope we continue to bang out these shows.
Tune in this week for SoCal. Tune in next week for Kansas City. Crazy good couple of weeks for streaming.
Yeah, when people are hearing this, they should be able to go to the Frontline Gaming Network Twitch page and see y'all bring in some top-tier competitive. Last year, the SoCal Open had great games the entire way. Lots of different lists than maybe what you were expecting there. So I think that speaks kind of what the meta that shows up, and looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
The couple of guys there have called their shots. I think they've got the off-meta juices to go the distance. I can't wait to see what comes out.
Thank you very much. We'll see y'all next week. Like, share, and subscribe.
See you then.
Scan is clear. I think they're gone. For now.